So we've just been speaking to Simon Parks, and we're just going to finish off with Simon talking to us about the birthday card incident, where he actually saw a birthday card in his local shop with pictures of him on it. So, Simon, if we can finish off with that story, okay. And then perhaps we will also perhaps wrap up with the most salient points of this experience so far.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just to finish off with the birthday card, good friend of mine, I won't mention his name, just call him John. He's an ex-Ministry of Defence policeman. He was a dog handler. And he'd had a conversation with me on the telephone regarding my birthday card. We refer to MI5 as the firm. And we had a maybe 20-minute conversation. 2 weeks after that, he was stopped in County Durham by a police officer who said, "I'm arresting you for driving without a driving licence." So John said, "Well, how can that be? I've got a driving licence." He said, "Well, not according to the DVLA. It was revoked 21 years ago.
Oh.
So he said, "Well, how can that be? Because 5 years ago, I renewed my passport and I had to use my photo card licence." So the police officer obviously wasn't stupid and said to him, "I can see something's not right here, but I have to go by what the DVLA tell me. I should by rights arrest you, but I'm not going to. If you can get another named driver insured to take the vehicle away, I'll let you sort it out with the DVLA." So he phoned the DVLA several times and got no reply. 2 months later, 8 weeks later, he hadn't been able to drive because he had no driving licence, apparently. He got a phone call from a young lady from the DVLA who said, "Just phoning to let you know that your driving licence has been reinstated."
Oh.
So he said, "Oh, that's really good. Why has it been reinstated?" And she said, "I don't know. The computer screen doesn't tell me that."
And why was it revoked?
Well, that's what he asked. And the reply was, "I'm sorry, the computer screen doesn't tell me that." So anyway, he then didn't phone me. We had a meeting for something else, and he came out of the house first off and took me aside. And he said, "Look," he said, "Simon," he said, "I piss them off and I get my driving license taken away for 2 months. You piss them off and you get a birthday card." And I said, "Well, you've either got it or you haven't." But the sad thing is from that now that he no longer wants to telephone me because he's obviously aware that the line's been listened into. He won't phone me. It doesn't want to come to the house anymore. But we have meetings on other issues,
yes,
when there are other people.
Yeah.
And it's just very sad that what was a good friendship has now been forced because of outside influences. Mm. But it just shows how things are manipulated.
Mm. And it does impact...
Of course it does, and he's now very frightened because his business, he relies totally on the car, and if they've taken it away once, they'll take it away again. So it was a warning, and he's...
Yes, he took it as a serious warning.
Definitely.
And how would you... So you've had a good few years of experience now of all this interaction. How would you say it's impacted on your general domestic daily living?
Academically, it's had a terrible effect on me. I don't have a university degree, and I'm sure if I hadn't been interacted, I probably would have had a reasonably good academic background. However, the positive side, my ability to interact with people.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I got into politics, all the jobs that I've had with local authorities. I've managed large teams of people, motivated people, achieved things that others haven't. So from that perspective, it's been enhanced.
So do you also feel that you had any particular accenting of any abilities or giftings in a higher intuitive perspective or manner?
Oh, very
perhaps?
Long words.
Yes, I don't know quite how to put it succinctly, really.
Well, I mean, I can bend knives and forks with my mind, but unfortunately, apart from going into a circus, it doesn't really do you any good. It
doesn't pay the bills.
No. I think what I would say is that the advantage has been to a wider learning, a wider understanding, that the crap that is told to the mass population just isn't true.
Yes.
I have seen beings from another dimension, and I know that what we're being taught in school is wrong.
Yeah.
The problem is that you have to try and cope with this. You have to, when you try and find someone to talk to, there isn't anybody. It's something that people will run shy from. And so you tend to think, well, I'll hide it. I'll internalise it and I'll hide it. And I said during the earlier interview how I rationalised things away to try to cope with them when I was much, much younger. But the only reason that I'm competent to sit here and talk to you is because those experiences have been positive, in as much as, to my knowledge, I haven't been physically abused. When I've asked them a question, I've had an answer. They've actually asked me before they've done something. So if they want to do something, they'll say, can we do that? Do we have your permission? So I've never felt a victim.
And also you mentioned earlier on as well some relation to your wellness, your well-being, that they said that it would
I don't know if you've got 2 or 3 minutes, I'd just like to say in 1969, I was 10 years old, and my best friend had come to the house, and my mum, human mum, was at work, and we were playing at the back of the house, and it was an old Victorian house and a concrete drop. And I always remembered, I lost my balance on this. I have no recollection of falling, no recollection of hitting the ground at all. But all I ever remembered until recently was, next minute, was standing by my bed, pulling my bed covers back and saying, oh, I don't feel very well. And getting into the bed, and my friend, who had gone running in to get help, because nobody was in the house, came running out and saw me and was running at full pelt and stopped. And what he said was, that when I was on the ground, he was calling me and I wasn't speaking. And he said, I thought you were unconscious. And he said, how did you sort of get yourself up? The memory I've had back, I remembered the moment that I lost my footing. I have no recollection of falling or hitting the ground. But the next thing I know is a crow, a big black crow, huge crow flying towards me. And I'm thinking, don't land on me because you'll crush me. It's such a big, and it flies down, and then its wingtips come round, and it like picks me up. It tucks its wingtips under me, under my back, and then lifts me up. You know, like you would hold something like that, and it flies off with me. But it doesn't flap its wings because it's holding me like that. And the next thing I remember are the two mantid doctors over me working. Now, normally when the doctors are doing something, they're quite like this. They're quite taking their instruments, but these ones were going like this. They never panic, but it was really... And I said to them, what's happened to me? And very matter-of-fact, said, you died.
Yeah.
And I said, I died? He said, yes, but don't worry, we will return you. And the next memory, I'm back at the bed, pulling the bedclothes back, I don't feel very well. Now, then in 2009, when I was teaching a pupil, stupid woman went into the back of us, and I hurt my hands and a bit of whiplash. So off to hospital, and x-ray, and the doctor says... Oh, you're all right, it's just soft tissue damage. But I'd like to talk to you about the damage to your spine. How did that happen? So I said, what damage to my spine? And she was quite nonplussed and says, you don't know about that. And I said, no, what damage? And she says, well, you didn't go to hospital then. I said, no, what damage? She said, well, we usually see severe damage to the spine with heavy contact sports. Have you played rugby? No, I said, I've never played rugby. By this time, I'm more worried about... I said, no, I haven't. Said, well, what sort of damage? And she says, well, it's all right, it's old damage. It's healed now. I said, yeah, but what is it? She said, your spine was broken. But
wow.
Snapped in half, but has healed. I said, there's nothing we can do for you. And she said, are you sure that you don't remember this? And I said, no. I said, well, not to worry then.
And do you get any back problems? Or
not at all. Now, what I should do under freedom of information is write to James Cook Hospital and ask for that x-ray.
You should. That would be very interesting as evidence.
And I now think that that was caused
that
because
time.
Of that. But my friend Malcolm, who said to me, you know, you weren't moving, I was shouting my name, you weren't speaking. And he said, how did you get to the bed? How did you get up? And it was about 40, 50 feet. About now. And so you said how it's changed me. It doesn't make me grateful of them because they only do what they want to do. And it suited them. You know, I'm not a fool. They call the shots from that perspective. But whatever it is about me that interests them, it's enough for them to do that.
Yes. Yeah.
It's enough for them to do that. So there's a definite relationship between us. And you could say they're very, very clever because I've never been pushed away once. Never been pushed away, never been hurt. Never raised a voice, never been angry, always asked me. In fact, they've been nicer to me than people. Isn't that a horrible thing to say? But that's the reality.
Yes,
of it.
You did mention
more,
that.
More genuine in that sense of the word. If they've lied to me, I haven't caught them out yet. But then they don't show me things that they know I won't like. So it's very selective.
Yes.
They'll only show me stuff that they know I'm going to be okay with. So I do realise that. But it seems to me that I've been around them for thousands of years. I know I haven't. It's 51 years, but it seems that it's thousands of years. So therefore my relationship with them, I know them better than most people on the earth. So that's really, I think, what I just sum up to answer the question, that what have I got out of it? I've got a wider understanding and a wider knowledge. Go on then. A wider understanding and a wider knowledge, but I haven't got anything material out of it.
And the book that you're writing, just to wrap up, because I would like to bring in a friend that we've got visiting, who's Wynne Keach, and I hope that he'll stay for some chat and discussion, which would be great. But are you doing that on the from their suggestion, or is this some impulse within you since, you know, you've come to a sort of certain path in your life? Or
I have no knowledge of them saying I need to do it, but I really feel driven to do it. You know,
look forward to reading it.
I feel I have to do it. Yes, well, hopefully it'll be out early next year, so fingers crossed.
Fantastic. And let's hope you'll be able to speak at it at an AMASH conference.
Oh, yes, that would be fun, wouldn't it?
Well, let's invite Wynne to come and join us. So we have a guest with us who's joined us, Wynne Keach, and we're going to have a chat with him about some of his experiences and information, not necessarily as a contactee, but certainly someone who's been in the field of research for many years.
Yes, no, Wynne, in the field is definitely a good pun. I spend most of my time up to my knees in rainy, wet cornfields filming things in the pitch darkness. That's probably the thing I'm best known for. But what a lot of people don't realise is that 20 years previously, I'd also been a very active UFO researcher and photographer and investigator with quite a degree of success, which has helped me make better understanding of the crop circle phenomenon, which obviously is something that's peripheral to it initially, but actually turns out to be driven by the same kind of relationships with non-corporeal entities that you tend to find in the UFO environment.
And do you feel that it's all entity creation of the crops?
The crop circle phenomenon is very complex. It ranges from human activity, making artwork and designs for whatever reason, right up to the ones I've been tracking particularly, which is some discarnate consciousness which was interacting with local energy to produce complex formations that communicated directly to people.
And again, the communication that what was the communication about?
It's all connected. It's all connected to the reactivation of DNA within people. It's very much. It's actually a multi-factor authentication process that identified, and it's one of these things where you start to engage in the process. It provides you with a credential which you are then challenged to understand. It then produces something else, and all the time you're connecting to the energy signature of the formation that you've been into.
Yes.
And from that point onwards, your DNA is linked to it. And as you go through this process, you're led from one understanding to another, until the communication has converged to a certain point. And I think for many people, including myself, that effectively reached the conclusion last July.
Right.
And that what about your work with the Mendelssohn Forest UFO event? So the DNA specifically, the 1980 participants of the 1980 Mendelssohn Forest Bentwaters incidents?
That's very interesting in itself. Because of the work I'd carried out for the previous 15 years, studying the crop circle phenomenon and the connection to DNA activation, when I was presented with the opportunity to assist Linda Moulton Howe to film the 30-year reunion activity actually in the fields in the dark, because there was potential for things to happen there, I was asked as a night filming expert to go down and cover the fields, which I did. But in doing so, I obviously met John Burroughs, Jim Penniston, and found them to be very, very interesting, very decent people. And talking to them, they were quite surprised how much I knew about the DNA communication side that they were personally aware of, but obviously hadn't made very public.
Right.
And because of that, I was able to show that I'd encountered exactly the same thing in the crop fields with the crop formations. And as a result, the same process was going on here in a different form. So although on the surface it would look as if they're two completely disconnected things, actually the process that's going on is identical, but for different reasons.
And do you think that's happening planetary-wide?
Yes, and I think at various levels. I think there are many external influences now that are using this window of opportunity to access human DNA as it is now, before there are any significant changes internally to it, so that they all have their own agendas for either rejuvenating their own gene pool, because we share common genetic material from our long history in this planet, and also for forward hybridization, so that they may be able to enter this reality in a corporeal form. So there isn't just one or two or three separate off-world interdimensional entities doing this. There are dozens, and they all have slightly different agendas.
And also on another sort of maybe slant or level, do you think there is also the element that the DNA, as it becomes more activated or light encoded or whatever that process is, that there is then what is becoming known as the ascension process going on now, whether ascension means that we just are able to access higher frequency realization of whom we are?
It's part of that. I don't buy into the full ascension.
I know it's a difficult word. I was looking for another word.
In that I don't see that you're going to wake up one morning and suddenly the whole world's changed to a different frequency vibration. What's actually happening is that we've gone through a crossroads in this last couple of years, and people that are moving down an evolutionary path where they become able to access higher and higher frequency components are doing so. And that is definitely happening. And this is why entities that are at lower frequency perspectives are trying to access us now, because we're actually starting to recede from their reach.
Right.
But I see that humanity is probably going to split into two fundamental routes. There will be people who won't actually move from the position they are in now, and they will probably start to eventually breed out generation by generation on this planet.
Yes, yeah.
And the other components of the population, the component that's now positively evolving, are the ones that are going to have access to a wider reality range than we have now.
Mm. And maybe that feeds in also nicely, Simon, with a lot of what you've been saying and your experiences. Would you say that's...
I think Wynne knows what he's talking about. I think he's hit it right on the head.
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of my experiences, they've made it very clear that they say to me, you exist on two worlds. Mm. So they want my genetic material, particularly for the hybridization. Mm. I do agree that we're not going to wake up one morning, hallelujah.
No.
It's a period of time, but it's already started.
Yes.
Yes, that's also the way I see it. I see it that, for instance, the species that Simon's had dealings with are one of a type that are looking to our near future, where they'll see that the percentage of our population is going to effectively devolve out of existence. And so there is going to be some capacity within this reality range for people who can exist in both states.
Right.
To provide genetic material that can be used in hybridization so that they can take up some of the capacity that's made available.
Right. Yeah. Well, that really is interesting.
Yes, I think it goes to the question you asked, you know, why is there that capacity? Where will all the humans go? And I mean, that's where it becomes a very difficult debate.
Yes. Well, there's lots of different thoughts on that, aren't there? Parallel dimensions, universes and planets and bodies and what have you. But
specifically, in what way are you talking about? Are you talking about toxic takeover, soul?
I'm saying that you know, if the extraterrestrials wanted to take over, they would have done so. So they haven't done so. So they're waiting, what I would call in a natural way, for when the time is right, when there becomes a vacancy, let's put it like that, that there becomes a vacancy on this earth where they can move in without having to come by in force.
In other words, you're talking about termination of the existing human species,
yes,
new world order activity.
Well, yeah, and what I'm saying is that they won't come here until there is plenty of land for them. Now,
so when we've done the job ourselves.
What makes that available for them? Well, you know, they're not going to do it themselves.
You're hedging on this.
Of course I am. Of course I am. Because it's
what you mean.
Well, I can only tell you what I've learnt from them. And I don't have all the answers. I've never pretended to. All they've said to me, and I'll repeat what I said earlier, is that there is going to be a very difficult time on the earth. But you, and that's me, you will always be provided with food and you will always be provided with water. And then when I said, what will I do for company? They said, well, you already know you're compatible with any female here. So what they're saying to me is there is going to be a time of either natural problems or governmental enforced problems, and that there will be a time when there are fewer people on this earth, and that's when we're going to come in. So it won't be that there'll be a necessarily a landing and a great big battle. I think, you know, you said it yourself, we'll do it for them. Mm-hmm. Our governments will do it for them if we let them. If we let them.
Mm. Yes, what would you say of Chris Thomas's work about the Anunnaki, the Vailon threat, who have seen it following that agenda? Have you heard of his work?
Yes, I mean, they don't use the word Anunnaki. I mean, well, I won't talk about names that we use. They have their own names for them. But what they've said is that the time is coming and it'll be a time for them. They've also said that the door is closing. And that relates to what Wynne is saying. They've said to me the door is closing, that their opportunity to do what they wanted to do is diminishing. But they, until very recently, they haven't had the technology to make a stable hybrid. What they've said is hybrids have only lived for a few years and then they go, we would call it insane. Mm. They just don't survive. And so that's pointless because you've put a soul into something that's only going to last a few years. So they've been working like crazy to create that. They've said to me they have contacts with governments. They have intermediaries. I've seen, you know, you look on the net, they have what they call super soldiers. Super soldiers are only humans copied on an extraterrestrial form. Hitler did it. I mean, you know, we've got to wake up to this. Hitler called them the SS, the Schutzstaffel, the security staff. The ones that the extraterrestrials have are called super special human soldiers, SSHS, and in reptilian it's sus, sus. That's how a reptilian will say it, sus, super special human soldiers. I've seen them, and they are humans, and they don't sort of go in a tank and see how long they can stay in a vat of cold water. You know, not that sort of. That's what the American government is trying to create. It's trying to do a very poor copy of what the extraterrestrials have had and have had a long time. The extraterrestrials have always used humans to fight their wars for them, but now they are more advanced. The super soldiers from the extraterrestrials will have a very strong power suit. There are rifles. When they put the helmet on, there's something that goes into the mouth, and I don't know if it's a DNA contact or what it does. I've never worn one. I'm not a soldier, thank God. I've reviewed them. And when I've been in an extraterrestrial body, I have reviewed these soldiers. I wave my rod anti-clockwise and go along, and they salute. They salute by holding the weapons like that. But they're humans, and they are groups of humans who will be used at key points. And my understanding is that it will be when a government goes down a certain route, and they will have just a small group. These aren't thousands and thousands, they're numbered in the hundreds, but they will use them at key points.
Yeah,
because they will expect human soldiers to do the jobs for them.
Yeah,
that's something I've actually found with for instance the shadow entities in the crop circles. They have little to no physical impact upon our reality. They appear in our reality frame. You can see them, well, you can't really see them with the naked eye, but you can see them with infrared cameras, and you can see their activity. But they haven't the ability to physically bend one stem of corn. But they seem to specialise in persuading people to do the work for them. Mm-hmm. And all the
For instance, setting up a psychological imprinting of some kind.
Well, yes, they seem to have control over certain sort of networks of people, and certainly the harassment I suffered was all from people that they'd sent. And yet, I'm there alone in a field looking at these things, looking at me. They can just come over on the van door and knock and pass on the message, but they can't even do that. They have to send somebody to do it, which to me tells me they have really no physical direct influence in this reality at this moment in time.
And that's when I put my hand through one. Exactly. I actually put my hand right through one. There's no substance to them. So they if they want their jobs doing, they've got to have to use humans to do it.
And you have encountered a positive one sort of teaching you at some point.
Oh, I don't say
you?
Positive. I think that my relationship with it was positive.
Right,
in other
yeah.
words,
I
didn't see it
as
it
anything
came to me as a
yeah.
teacher
okay.
to teach me something, and I just accepted it
yeah.
as a teacher. I didn't have negative or positive feelings.
No, it was okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, I have had a recent experience of a shadow. It didn't do anything to threaten me, but it attempted to overrule me by being something like 20 feet high. It appeared while I was in the allotment, and I saw a shadow of a tree, and what's that? And then up 20 feet high. And I said, I don't want to see you, go. And every time I said, I don't want to see you, it shrank and shrank and shrank until it was about 4 or 5 feet high. And then it offered me a female. So there was a naked woman on the floor. And I said, that's not a real woman. That's not real. Can't bribe me with something that's not real. So that vanished. But it didn't say anything more. And I just went up to it and I actually put my hands on the sides of its head. And I said, I don't know why I said this. I said, I will burn you out from the inside and make you a hollow creature unless you go. And on the word go, vanished, but there was just a black, imagine a silk handkerchief, a black silk handkerchief, and if you just let that go and it just gently wafted down, that's all that was left, and then it just vanished before it hit the ground. But at no point was it violent or nasty or threatening, it just was its sheer size. And what that was about, I really don't know. But I wasn't going to have any of it.
No, absolutely.
So how did you two get together then?
Well, yes. Well, I was giving a talk for a friend at a conference locally, and Simon came to the talk. I was giving some showing some film footage of the shadow entities entering the fields in Wiltshire, and Simon immediately recognised these because he'd encountered these face to face in person. And so Simon came to talk to me at the end of the lecture and said, "Look, these things. I've seen these. I'd like to know, are they real? Is what I've experienced relevant? And anything you can sort of help me with to help understand what I've experienced would be useful." So arranged to meet Simon and came over to offer my perspective on my personal observations of these things and my understanding of them. And what Simon was then able to show me was that he had very extensive and very life-changing contact with these and other entities. But at that time he was starting to have recollection of the experiences, but he didn't understand almost the sort of the narrative of it as to how all the pieces fitted together. There was no sort of coherence to it. There was just, a recollection of this, a recollection of that. He didn't understand what the details meant and was looking for some kind of pattern or understanding to the details he was recalling. And I was able to quickly recognise what was going on there, but obviously offering Simon just enough for him to understand on his own terms what was going on. I didn't want to lead Simon into thinking things were one way or the other. I just provided the information that Simon requested as he went through this stage so that he could make a better understanding. And I concluded from that what had actually happened was Simon had been approached and identified at a very young age and was put through a series of tests. And this was your initial contact point with these shadow type entities and others. And they were testing him for, first of all, telepathic ability, and then secondly for precognitance. Mm. And once they'd established that he had the capability for both these things, they then went on to further tests, and Simon then escalated through further tests and revision and then some teaching from them, and then obviously came out top of the class and was then thrown into the big league of meeting further entities, some of which I've had experience of, and some I really haven't had direct experience of. So it really was quite a fascinating personal story that unfolded because of this.
What specifics are you talking about in terms of entities, other beings, if you want to talk about that?
Okay.
Crystal being, that was one, wasn't it?
Crystal being is one.
Yes, I don't think you mentioned that one, Simon.
No, it's into the kitchen, five what I call robot greys came in. And then just literally through the wind of the wall was a beautiful, beautiful, like, think of a chandelier, but this had a face, and there were shards of crystal rotating around it. Mm. And one of the greys gets me by the hand and pulls me, because I'm not sure I like greys, so I don't really like them, to bring me right underneath this. And obviously some form of communication, and unfortunately I've got no knowledge of any communication. But that was something that Wynne helped me with, to help me to understand. And Wynne's great researcher. He can go away and do some research and then let me know. But Wynne's right. Sometimes he infuriates me because he doesn't tell me. I'll ask him something, and he's doing it to help me.
Yes, I understood. I just understood.
Bloody tell me, Wynne.
Yes.
He won't. I mean, Wynne, you remember the very first time we met, and you said to me, you've been around these creatures so long, you've taken on their personality.
Yes.
And what it amazed me was that within 2 minutes, no, not even that, within 20 seconds, this man could identify that was the case. Mm. Because when he looked at the drawings, he was saying, oh, I know what that is. Oh, I know what that is. Mm. And could then back it up.
Brilliant.
Whereas when you speak to, I've spoken to most people, they say, well, I haven't a clue about that.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, and that's why Wynne is so special to me, because my experience is pretty detailed.
Yes.
And a lot of researchers I've spoken to get lost.
Yes.
Because they think, I can't keep up with it.
Yes.
Not being rude, they just say, well, I just can't manage it. This man copes with it.
Yes.
So he's been a real godsend, because he's been supporting me, but we're not leading me, and that's what he's saying. He's not
leading
me.
Absolutely. No,
I've been very careful not to lead you or cross-contaminate you with things that I know.
Yeah.
Because yours, I think, is a very important story, and it is something that shouldn't be sullied or in any way tainted by any external influence, including myself. So I've been very careful not to do that.
It makes me angry sometimes.
Well, I know, it's frustrating, that's all it goes.
But what came of the crystal entity?
It was that Wynne had done some research and found that this crystal was known and had been working with American military as a sort of an intermediary.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard about this one.
No, it's quite new, and a lot of researchers don't like the idea because they're comfortable with, you know, your usual run of baddies. So here was a new one that was brought on the scene, and well, where's this one come from? New kid on the block. And so a lot of researchers, very much from a human perspective, won't accept it. They have a problem with it. But this creature, when I can't remember any communication at all, but what I remember is if you were to take a glass jar, jam jar, and fill it with marbles and shake it, that's what it sounded like when it was communicating with me. And then, after a while, that changed, and I could then understand it. But I can't tell you what it said.
So
to start with, it was like marbles in a jam jar.
Familiarising you with its language or its
communication. I don't know. I think it was just chatting to me and then thinking, oh, he's not understanding me, and maybe then having to change a frequency or something. And then, but all I can tell you is I know it came to ask me something. Mm. It came to ask me something, and I said yes. That I don't know anyone that. Mm. But reptiles, I won't want to bring Wynne on this one. Well, I won't go into it in too detail a subject because there's a lot to it that perhaps is best not for tonight. But my memories for the last year have all been about mantids and greys and Nordics. But very recently, reptiles. And these memories are not very good. I haven't even told tonight. I told you one, and I haven't mentioned to Wynne. And
I would be interested in Wynne's take on this if you've got 2 minutes.
That's fine.
Yeah, make hay while the sun shines, guys.
Okay. Can you hear all right?
Cause
yeah. Okay.
It's just, for instance, if you want to say something that you don't want to have released later.
Yeah.
Say it now, and then we don't release it later.
No, all it is that there's an agenda with the reptilians that is very near the knuckle, and you know we have to be careful with it. As I know how intermixed with politics and military they are, and sometimes you bring Amesh does not want the system closing it down now, and if we go too far down that road, that's what will happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're ready?
I'll talk about a bit of the reptiles, because I'll talk about my experience, because I haven't told Wynne this, and that will be useful. Mm-hmm. I sent you a few drawings, Wynne, regarding the reptiles, and you'd said because your mind is just beginning to cope with it now, you're coming back with them. But I did want to just run this one past you. The reptile that threw Adam and Eve out from the Garden of Eden, I went to see that one, and when I saw it, I referred to it as Daddy.
Ah, that's okay.
And he took me and put me in a chair. Well, no, he asked me, would you like to go in the chair? And said, what would you like? And I said, what can I have? And he said, how about a nice young female? So I was able to think of a female.
And this is when you're six and a half
years old. And I said, I like that lady on the Fry's Turkish Delight advert. I'll have her. So he said, think of her. I think of her, there she is. He said, do you know what to do with her? No. He said, if you like, I'll enter your mind and show you what a human female is for. So we have sex with her. She's just a holographic thing, but he shows me, and he's very graphic, and he shows me all what to do. And then he says, we have shared a female together. Now would you like to eat her? This is horrendous. Okay, unless you've under, this is horrendous. This is holographic. And I say, no, because if she's going to be pregnant, I want the baby to be like me. And he says, no, it's only in our minds. She's not manifest. That's the word he used. I said, you know, but you have to do this, otherwise we won't be father and son. And I say, well, I thought we were father and son. He said, no, but in our law, a father must share the feast of a vanquished foe for us to be father and son. So I do have a go at it, and it's just holographic, it's not real, but she screamed like hell. And he says, enough feasting. And then he says to me, would you like to command armies? Said, with your tactical mind, with your ability to lead, you could go from star system to star system, bringing order where there is disorder, rule of law where there is chaos. He has it all laid out, and I all the time say no. But the worrying thing for me is that although we agreed to disagree, he said the offer is still open and will always be open to you.
Yeah, this seems to me it's an analogue of the hunting tradition of blooding. It's trying to form an agreement or a bonding in blood. So I think that entity was trying to trick you into forming an agreement with it so that it could pursue its own purposes under that agreement, even if you didn't know the extent of it at that time.
Right.
So I think you did exactly the right thing to reject it. And certainly the reptilians do display sort of cunning and deceit at every twist and turn. Mm. And you can see from your experiences peripherally with them in your earlier experiences how they will use projections in your mind to try and change your mood or change your approach or attitude towards something. So that if they want to try and control you, they want to project an image of something that will calm you down or convey authority to try and shepherd you in one direction. So, yes, they certainly seem to be deceptive creatures.
This one had wings. Not great huge wings, small little wings. But a most horrible face. When I draw the mantid face...
You probably think
face,
that's of you.
Right. When I draw the mantid face, it's fairly accurate. Yeah. But with this one, it's more... Horror is in the true sense of the word. Mm-hmm. Horror in the true sense of the word. But at least it's showing me what it looks like. That's the one good thing. That's its reality.
Mm. I wonder if these also relate to, and you probably know when the Schneider, Phil Schneider experience as well. because I don't know if you know that story, and I don't know all the details now because it's a long time since I looked at the story, but basically he's a geologist, is that correct, Wynn? And he goes...
Allegedly, he had a firefight with them.
Yeah, they've got something that they need to research. So he goes, he sent down this hole that they've created, because there's something amiss or awry or something. I can't remember the exact details, as I said. But, anyway, he comes across a huge reptilian, and there, as Wynn said, a firefight opened, and he was horribly, you know, injured.
Yes.
I mean, he was very, very badly injured. Whether it was through a firefight with aliens and the reptilian, I don't know, but he lost some fingers, he had his internal organs burnt out, and I think it was only 2 years, wasn't it, that he was speaking before
he died quite suddenly.
Suicided.
Yes.
Suicided with his own catheter, was it? He was disabled through his injuries and stuff.
You see, the thing is that when I went to see this one, it was under the earth. And it was very hot.
Yeah.
Very hot, and I couldn't stand it. And they actually have tanks for humans to go in, and they do something to cool you down. And he said to me, the effects of this will last for many hours. So you'll be able to survive here without being in discomfort. Mm. But what the mantids have told me about the reptilians, because it could be a double bluff, but I do believe the mantids are playing a double game. Very dangerous against the reptilians. Mm. But what they've said is that a reptilian will know what you're thinking before you think it. But the mantids are still very, very perceptive. They're very clever. But what they're warning me, when I'm with them, I have to block. Because if I don't, they'll access. And when I told you, when I was on the mantid mothership, and they were basically saying to me, we don't share information with all of them. And I'm saying, well, you don't share it with the reptilians. And they say, oh, your family, you know. So although they're one group working towards supposedly an overall goal, they are working against each other.
But surely with this kind of disclosure as well, or sharing, let's say, that the reptilians will easily plug into this awareness now, do you think?
Well, no, because what they'll do is they can put, there'll be blocks in my mind, so when I'm with a reptilian, they won't be able to access that, because to do so would probably kill me.
But generally, I mean that the reptilians will then pick up that the mantids are doing this double buff game.
I think they already know.
Yes. Well, that's what I was thinking. How can they not?
The reptilians have been here a long time. Yeah. The reason that mostly they're under the ground is that they were wiped off the surface of the planet a long time ago. And only the branch that survived is the one that survived beneath the planet. But no, they definitely have their own agenda, and it's not a good one for humanity, because they look on humanity in a rather negative fashion. Mm-hmm. They see... you know, Homo sapiens sapien on this planet as a latecomer that has taken over their heritage, and their technology tends to be biologically based, and they see humanity as a biological source more than anything else.
Yes,
rather than an equal playmate in the playfield.
No, I understand that.
Whereas my understanding of the mantids is different, in that they're not especially emotional creatures. They're quite logical, as you would expect, somewhat insect-like in terms of having a defined hierarchy. But they are also an ancient race, and they seem to have evolved a highly sophisticated culture. And they have their own agenda, and they don't seem to make any bones about it. They want to have at least a portion of themselves have access to the same space that we're in now, and they see the ability to hybridise through people as being something crucial to their future development.
And what about folks like, you know, sort of the tall whites that we hear about from Charles Hall?
That's very interesting. I saw Charles Hall in Blackpool when he gave a talk this year. Very charming gentleman, very interesting. The tall whites do seem to be a distant relative of ours, really. That's the best way I can describe it, but one that is actually significantly further down an evolutionary path than ourselves. They're almost on the balance between physical and the ethereal.
Yes, that's the feeling I get. And also, I haven't heard of them anywhere else except through the Charles Hall experience. I mean, you hear of Nordics, but I know you mentioned Nordics, not that we've spoken about it much tonight, but the tall... I thought, you know, that's very intriguing, because also they're very private and independent.
They're very private, but they're also
using our resources,
physically real within our reality.
Yes, absolutely.
And they're actually very
and aggressive.
Well,
to a degree.
Well,
protective, perhaps, is the better word.
Well, I think they are assertive. I would say. I wouldn't say they're aggressive. I mean, if you look at the dealings they had with Charles Hall, they considered him to be a pet. They considered him a threat to them because of his physical size and strength compared to them. So they established quite rigid bounds.
Yes.
They consider themselves to be intellectual superiors and from an evolutionary line that was ahead of ours. But nonetheless, they respected Charles for who he was and his abilities and were continually surprised by him. And as a result of that, Charles effectively became a fantastic ambassador for humanity because they then saw through him the potential in humanity that other species just haven't.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. No, that was a really intriguing one. You were saying about the Nordics, Simon, but we didn't mention it in our previous discussions or chats. How have they interfaced with you, and perhaps Wynne as well, if you have something to say?
I haven't seen very many of them. I mean, everyone seems to, when you talk to them, they want to know which ET is on top, who gives the orders, and it seems to be, people seem to be really wound up about that. All I can tell you is that the few Nordics I've seen have worked with, but I've never had an instruction or Nordics. I've seen them in the background, but they've never actually come up. And the ones I've seen have been in the school in space, where one was a teacher, and he is obviously very human looking, so I reckon that's why he was in that role, because the children there from age 5 to about 11 or 12 could relate to him. And he, I would say, yes, I would say he was fairly spiritual. I'd say compared to the others on the ship, I'd say he had more spirituality about him. But this was a spaceship that weren't any reptilians on, so it was just mantids and greys and and Nordics. I've never seen a Nordic in the same area as a reptilian.
I don't think you will.
Never, never, never. But I've seen mantids and Nordics quite close together.
Yeah. Also, the mantids are sort of a Switzerland of species, and they're relatively neutral but have their own objectives. And so they don't really annoy anybody sufficiently for anybody to become aggressive towards them, and yet they have behind the seemingly small exterior, you know, formidable fortifications that they can bring into action. Yes, they're quite interesting. It's also, I think, an interesting observation that even if you see a Nordic, it could be very complex as to exactly what kind of Nordic that is and what the situation is there and why they're there. In the same way that if you saw a full human, which you have experienced humans on these ships.
Yes,
and,
so
and knowing where they're from, what their objective is equally complex. And I mean, I understand a lot of things from my research over the last 25 years, but I still don't understand humans on this planet. So, you know, and there are good and bad in humanity wherever you go. There are some of the greatest spirits in the universe are human in terms of, you know, their emotional and loving components, and yet some of the most evil, despicable people in the whole galaxy.
I can pick up on what Wynne said, where, on the experience where I saw the five human scientists. The lead scientist wasn't telepathic. He was British. He had a very upper-class accent. But the female was American. She was telepathic, and so she was communicating with the extraterrestrials and then verbalising what had been discussed back to her boss, as a boss of the scientist. And it was very interesting that these two were more comfortable around the extraterrestrials than the other three, who were obviously top scientists. And as I say, it just wanted to get the hell out of there. But they were not part of it. But you could see, I could see that, that this senior guy, he was in his 50s, and the young woman, say in the 30s, they clearly had, the, you know, it's like Laurel and Hardy. She'll do the conversation and report back to him. And he's got to trust that woman that what she's telling him is truth. Very interesting. But when I felt those scientists' minds, I felt that they were being tricked, that they were easily led, and that the people above them just give them the orders. They do what they're told. And some of these scientists were scared of their lives. They were frightened for their lives, and they were thinking of their families and that. And so I do think that a lot of people who are wrapped up in this are against their will.
Yes.
I really do. So I don't think everyone's bad.
No.
That's what Wynne's saying. I think there's a lot of people who are trapped.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they would get out if they could.
I mean, it's like, really, that sort of leads to your mum, in a way, because she was...
She was trapped.
Trapped, exactly. And maybe we haven't spoken about your mum in this discussion.
Really.
Maybe,
are
we all right?
10 minutes
Okay, 5 minutes. Okay. I always refer to her as my human mum, because I got very confused. I've got a mantid telling me that it's my mother, and I've got society telling me that the woman I live with is my mother. So it's sometimes I get confused and I move in and out. But mum was very gifted. She was a tremendously brilliant speller. Her spelling was phenomenal. Her dad was...
Did that come down to you as well?
No. Well, it might have done, but by the time the shadow being had done what it did to me, my educational ability went right down.
Okay.
But mother came from a blue blood background, because my grandfather was a British consul, high-ranking diplomat, OBE, CBE. He uncovered corruption in one of the Conservative prime ministers, and they offered him a knighthood. But he refused. He was a Mason, but bought himself out of the Masonic circle. Mm-hmm. He was, I always get confused with the kings, which was the king that was going to marry Mrs. Simpson?
That was Edward VIII.
Eighth, right. Well, what my grandfather told me was that the Prime Minister said, we've got a problem here, we can't have this man, but we'll form a jury of 12 men, and who will decide whether the king stays or goes. And my grandfather was one of them. And my grandfather was an Indian. He said it was a telex in those days, or a telegraph or something.
Yeah.
And the question was, should the king go or stay? And grandfather told me that he said the king's got to go.
Mm.
And the votes were 10 for him to go, 2 for him to stay. And my grandfather was one of those men that decided whether this guy was to be king of England. Mm. That's how powerful he was.
Yeah.
And then when he left... his role, they bought him, you'd be interested in this, they bought him lots of stocks and shares in Rolls-Royce engines, lots of stuff to buy him off, and then said, would you like to be in the United Nations, would you like to be an ambassador? And he was in the United Nations. He's actually the youngest sergeant major the British Army's ever had. I think he was 17 in the First War. So my mother had come from a background that was steeped in that anyway. And one day a guy that she knew from work turned up with somebody else and, went into the sitting room, and this guy who was the archetypal white shirt, black tie, dressed in black, sunglasses, says to my mum, get rid of the kid or get rid of the boy. I can't remember which now, just get rid of him. So I go out, but I shut the door, don't fight you two. I'm looking through the keyhole. And this guy just puts papers down on the table. There's a big to in and fro. I want you to sign these papers. And mum saying, no, I won't. Big argument. In the end, she does. And the bloke says to her, right, you've now signed the Official Secrets Act. You're cleared to a very high level. If you tell anybody about this or the work you do, you will be found on a railway line. And then who's going to look after your son? So with that, he walks out. And, mum's sort of talking to this guy that she knows. And basically he then starts turning up with documents. He's a translator, and they're all in German, and they have either secret, top secret, very top secret, stamped on the top in red ink, or in purple ink, extremely top secret.
And who was she working for?
Oh, MI5. Mm. I presume MI5 at the time MI5, but it wasn't. They managed the situation, but what this guy, I'll give you his name because he said it's not his real name, Paul Dunlop, said it's for the NSA.
Right.
So you're working for the NSA, but via MI5.
Hmm.
And a group of German scientists who weren't spirited away to America, who elected to stay in what was then West Germany.
Yes.
And elected to stay with their government, but it were all managed by MI5.
Hmm.
And so the German government was allowed to stamp the eagle on it and put Berlin on it, but that... to save face, but that wasn't for them. It came away and it was shared in Britain and America. And this group of scientists were specialists in a particular field, where most of the scientists were in America, but there were some fields they were lacking.
Mm-hmm.
But here was this group, and so they would have staff. And these documents, what would happen is mum would work at home, and she officially sort of gave up her job that she already had with a company, but she still got paid for that job. So she used to go in every Friday at 3:30 or 4:30 and pick up wages. that she never went into the office for, and this other guy gave her wages as well.
To keep the front
going.
Two
jobs. Yeah. Well, no, it was a bribery. So we'll give you two wages. She was a single parent, and, you know, I'll give you two wages. Mm-hmm. And when your work with us finishes, you can go back to your other job. Well, you know, back in the 70s, if you were a single parent, she jumped at it. That's why she did it, I think. And she would go and have a cup of tea or make her lunch, and on the her work desk would be this document in German. And then she would have had a what we call a dictaphone, an old tape, and then Paul Dunlop would have translated it from German to English, and she'd be typing that document, and I'd just read it. And I would sit there and read the documents, and I'd hear her footsteps coming back, and I would run back and do
something. Yes, I take it you read it in secret.
Well, maybe.
She was having a ciggy break or something.
Well, maybe she did now. I don't know, but she left them out. And then the thing was, I was never asked to fulfill the Official Secrets Act in, but this guy, Paul Dunlop, would start having conversations with my mother, and I'm in the room. Mm. You know, and...
But you'd be what age, more or less?
I would be
about 10, 11?
About 11, about 11. So,
and so what subject matters were...
Well, the first one would be when she's sort of saying, well, this is the first day, is this true? And he's saying, well, I knew you'd be like this, you know, because he's obviously done it before, he knew you'd be like this. And she's saying, yes, it is all true. And when she's asking questions about extraterrestrials, he's been very, very... won't go down that road. But when he's bringing the papers work and he's discussing it with her, then he's talking about, well, this is a downed craft, this is what's come out of it, this is how far they've got with it. For instance, the bit that makes me laugh is they were trying to get a nuclear reactor really small, and in German it was, we're going to get this nuclear reactor the size of a VW car. And he says, well, they won't know what that is in America. So he puts a pencil line through VW Beetle and writes Mini. He says, they'll know what a Mini is. So he would have these discussions in front of her. And so he was saying, well, this is this technical bit. Can you understand this? And he was saying, well, when you're going towards the speed of light, you can't send information down cables because it'll never reach the computer. So you have to send it in pulsed light down fiber optics. So the computer can get it. And he's saying to Mum, do you understand that? Because when you're typing this out, unless you understand this concept, this won't make sense.
Yes, it won't. Yeah.
So, and he's chatting away like this to her, and, you know, and he was a RF pilot. He used to fly Lightnings.
Is he British?
I can't answer that. I don't know. He had an English accent.
Right.
But he had, he's going to laugh, blue eyes, blonde hair, he was about 6'3". And he used to teach karate, and he was really, really quite an amazing character. And he was above the law, because he would do things which he would be arrested for, and within 20 minutes he was always released from prison. He had his own private aeroplane, he had his Formula 2 sports car, he had his own MG4, and this was a really interesting character. And whenever Mum was working on what he called the purple group, these are the purple documents, the most secret documents you can get, extremely top secret in purple, there would be a GPO van parked 24 hours a day right outside the house. And on one occasion a travelling salesman knocked on the door to try and sell Mum some, you know, cleaning cloths and that, and they were straight there. And they said to Mum, do you know where the telephone lines come into this building? He said, no, I don't know. And they just stood there watching him. And when they'd gone, Mum turned to me and said, I never want another man in this house, because she never had a boyfriend, she never remarried. She said, but it's nice to know we're being watched. So she knew that. And I don't swear, but she used to call them the purple F-U-C-K-E-R. Oh, not another purple F-U-C-K-E-R. Oh, God. Because she just became manic. She knew that the content of these about alien spacecraft that had been brought down. He never said how they came down, what was being taken out of them.
Were these in England as well?
Oh, all over the world. The Americans go and get them. The Americans get them and they go to America, and then America decides, right, well, what can we do with this? What can we do with that? And what Paul said of the human race, he said the human race are absolutely brilliant at taking something apart. Brilliant. And they know what it should do. They just can't quite make it do it. And he said, if you think of 100%, he said, what we've got here is only giving us 10% of what they're capable of, but that 10% puts us hundreds of years. And, you know, it was, and I was just chatting away in front of me, and it was just incredible that I was involved in these conversations, and he would turn to me sometimes and just smile. And now looking back on it, I'm thinking, that's not right.
That's so he was priming
odd.
You.
I don't know what he was doing, but it just doesn't seem right to have that. Mm. And I mean, you know, very odd. Very odd. So.
Didn't this disturb your mother after a while?
Yeah, poor mum. She became an alcoholic. She couldn't cope with it. She went and asked to get out. They released her, and then within 2 weeks she was dead. She met a man who convinced her to take herbal medicine to make her asthma better. So she did, and then 2 weeks later she had a heart attack and died. But what is interesting is that her wages still came through for the next 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I still got her wages for the next 2 years. And then when I decided to leave England, you don't even know this, Wynne, when I decided that I was going to leave Brighton and come to London, I got an offer for another job, I was going to do it. The day beforehand, I got an envelope through the door with £2,000 in used notes and a little type, and it's been typed on a golf ball. Do you ever remember the golf ball? And it said, "Don't look back, Dick Whittington." Wow. That's what it said. Don't look back.
And how old were you when your mum went?
I was 18 and a half when she died.
So
something like that.
So quite young
stuff. Oh, yeah. No brothers and sisters. Mm. No, on my own. So I call that blood money.
Yeah.
And so they're guilty. That's why I've not had a slap round the wrist, I don't think, because they are guilty for what they did.
Yeah. Well, Simon and Wynne, thank you very much. I think we've got to wrap that up, and that's another really interesting AMASH discussion. I think we're going to have a few more of these. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks Miles.
Hey.
Well done, Miles. And I'm sorry about the cat, but you've got some lovely cat pictures there. Keep them in, don't cut them out.